You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar, and he says what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. Each week, OWW Radio will bring perspective to the WWE, TNA, and everything else making news in the world of professional wrestling. My name is David, and this week I welcome wrestling promoter Mr. Peter Burkholz, author of the recent book, When Wrestling Was Wrestling, The Wild and Exciting Inside Story of the Legendary Houston Wrestling Promotion. This book details the history of Houston wrestling, and I thought it was a really interesting narrative and a book that I would highly recommend. Hello, Mr. Burkholz. Thank you for taking the time to join me today, and congratulations on your recent publication.
Well, thank you, David.
For starters, there is a great quote by your son in the foreword. He writes, "This was an era when men of honor ruled the ring, when heels always cheated and still lost, and when the celebrated athletes of previous generations were still in their prime and no one could beat them. Wrestlers today often imitate these superstars of yesteryear, but they can never replicate Gorgeous George, Lou Thesz, Ed Strangler Lewis, or Buddy Rogers." And I wanted to ask you, Mr. Burkholz, does this kind of help explain the title you chose for the book, When Wrestling Was Wrestling?
Yes, it does, David, because to me, when wrestling was wrestling, back in those days, so many wrestling fans referred to it as wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that to be a unique title to try to describe the era of professional wrestling in which I promoted and which I wanted wrestling fans of today to realize what it was like back in the days of the regional wrestling promotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted wrestling fans of yesteryear to reminisce, and that's been one of the fun things. I've had so many people tell me it took them back to their childhood.
Well, I thought the book was a great look back at the Houston wrestling promotion, and you start your narrative on page one with the quote that says, "There is an old Native American saying that states it takes 1,000 voices to tell a story." How does that apply to Houston wrestling?
Well, it does in my case because I grew up in a wrestling family. My father was a professional wrestler, and, of course, my uncle was the legendary Paul Bosch.
Mm-hmm.
And so even as a youngster, when we had family get-togethers, there would always be wrestlers there, and then I'd be in the dressing room as a little boy, and I grew up in the dressing room. And I would hear so many stories, and I would hear it from the wrestlers themselves. And then as you find out by reading the book, the 25 years I spent in wrestling, I acquired some stories on my own. But, David, it was so unique back then because that's when you used to travel by car. And you'd get into a car and you'd be with Bronco Lubitsch or Waho McDaniel or Lou Thesz and you travel to the next town. You never turned on the radio.
Right.
You had a carload of wrestlers and then nothing was told but just story after story. And there was a folklore there that I tried to capture some of that in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you please talk a little about what professional wrestling meant to the city of Houston itself?
Well, it was very popular, and Paul Bosch and my uncle was very good about giving back to the community. In fact, when readers read the book, they're going to find that the first wrestling promoter, Morris Siegel,
mm-hmm.
who was for nearly 50 years promoted Houston wrestling, there was just this obligation you felt and responsibility to give back to the community. And back in those days, that was so important to establish a promotion and then to keep you successful. Morris Siegel promoted for 50 years was successful. Paul Bosch and I promoted for, in Paul Bosch's case, for 25 years. And so what it was to give it back to the town. And we had wrestlers who would go out and visit the children's hospitals. We would have wrestlers who go out and visit the Center for the Mentally Retarded. Would have wrestlers go out, including myself and Paul Bosch, and speak at schools about telling youngsters, get a good education and stay away from drugs. So there was this community interaction that we felt that we were a positive force in Houston, and the Houston fans supported us because I think they appreciated that.
Of course, you mentioned Morris Siegel. The first promoters, though, of Houston were Morris and his brother Julius, correct? And then Julius moved on to New Orleans to work down there, and then Morris became basically the king of Houston wrestling for the next 52 years.
Right, and he, I tell you, I met him as a young boy a couple of times, but it wasn't until I did the research on this book and that I realized just what a great promoter he was and what a great philanthropist he was, David. He gave back so much to the community, and I mentioned it before. Back in those days, that was very important.
The City Auditorium, which opened in November of 1910, became the home of Houston Wrestling for, it's unbelievable, 47 years. What made that venue so special?
Well, interesting enough, when it was first built, and as you mentioned, in 1910, it was supposed to be the premier auditorium of the whole entire south of the country. But what made it so unique was downtown Houston, and it was just kind of right in the middle of the hub of all the activity as Houston started to boom and go from a town to a big town to onto a big city. And it was just a unique auditorium, and it was so diversified. It was interesting that it not only had the Houston wrestling matches every Friday night, but Moore Siegel had a special arrangement with the city of Houston on events he promoted there. He got a cut of the food and drink concession. Well, you and I both know that helps the promoter at the end of the night.
Sure.
When he's counting his cash, and, you know, he's got ticket prices to pay expenses, and then he's got money off the beer and popcorn. But he would promote boxing on a regular basis, and then other promoters would go in there. And in fact, Moore Siegel even promoted some country western dances, and individuals like Willie Nelson would star there. And then Elvis Presley even came over and made a couple appearances in his younger days in the City Auditorium. So I don't know, there was a magical mystique about the City Auditorium that had all kinds of events and diversification, and I think that was one of the reasons why the Houston Wrestling was so successful, that it was an ongoing facility that people liked.
I thought you did a really nice job in the book, not only describing Houston wrestling, but really how professional wrestling evolved in the United States. Can you speak briefly on the importance of Frank Gotch and the popularity of professional wrestling in the United States at the time he was world champion?
Well, it's interesting because that was a very important, crucial period in professional wrestling as leading up to Frank Gotch's big victories over Hank and Smith. You know, as I pointed out in the book, it was mainly wrestlers would travel in carnivals and road shows, but it wasn't until Frank Gotch really put the spotlight on America and really got the media's attention that it allowed promoters to promote professional wrestling on their own. And that was a big step, David, because instead of having a professional wrestler and a traveling show come to town, you had individuals who started putting entire shows, two, three, four, five matches. And that was the entertainment that night was the wrestling just itself. It wasn't just part of someone's entertainment show. It was the entertainment itself. And it also, as it drew that attention, it also put pressure on promoters to provide the kind of action to bring people back. And that's when you started to see a little bit more mixture of the sport and the showmanship, because sometimes a legitimate wrestling match, when someone's sitting there with a side headlock for 20 minutes on someone else, well, That's great for some wrestling fans, but most wrestling fans, they want action. And so they had to start the mixture. And then through the years, as you know, you're very knowledgeable in professional wrestling, there was this evolution of the wrestling sport, showmanship, and then you started seeing a little bit more of the showmanship. And it also depended on the wrestler and the promoter themselves. But there was an evolution that was started there by Frank Gotch's victory, that professional wrestling took the center spotlight on its own, and from there they had to accommodate the fan, especially when television came onto the scene. Mm-hmm. They not only had to sell tickets, David, in the arena, as you know, they had to get that important television ratings, and a side headlock for 20 minutes does not produce the television ratings that television stations like to have.
I thought that was one of the most interesting parts of the book, and talking about when professional wrestling became more of a business rather than a sport. Explain what you meant in the book by the term, quote-unquote, doing business.
Well, that's when a wrestler and promoter realized that you could go out and have a match, or you can go out and put on a great show. And if you did it right, you'd make more money. And I think in the long run, too, fans got more for their money's worth. They got entertained. It wasn't just two guys beating the heck out of each other in the middle of the ring. If there was a show, there's a storyline, there's an angle, you brought it up to that point, and then you would continue it. And it was an ongoing story that wrestling fans like to follow. And you, what we found out by, and you know, other sports have picked that up. You know, I look at sports today, major sports, and there's so many elements of professional wrestling entwined. When I watch, you know, Ray Lewis take the field in football, it throws me back to my wrestling days. But you want to entertain and to do business, especially like in the carnival days. A professional wrestler learned very quickly. Let the local hero look really good. Let him look like he was going to beat you. Mm-hmm. And then time runs out, and the promoter sells tickets for the big rematch. And then when you pack this tent and everybody's got a lot of cash in their pocket, then you don't have to hold back. And if you want to, you can go out there and beat the local hero. But if you beat the local hero in 1 minute, what did you accomplish? You didn't make any money, and people go home not entertained. So doing business was very important and was carried through a theme that was carried through for several decades.
Mm-hmm. I liked how you broke this book down into the decades of Houston wrestling. When we get to the 1930s, you talked about the period of the Great Depression and how important it was for people. They needed a diversion. And professional wrestling really it grew in popularity during this time. When you broke the book down into decades, you focused on the characters who came through Houston. And in the 30s, you had really interesting guys like Whisker Savage and Irish Danny McShane, but you really focus on Lou Thesz. In fact, you call him, quote-unquote, the greatest during his prime. Why is Lou Thesz regarded in such high esteem?
Well, because I've watched him as I was growing up, and then also as I became more involved in the business and a promoter and a television producer myself, I learned to even have even more respect for him. And in my eyes, he was. And, of course, that's one of the great things about the any kind of sport or business. You're open for debate. I was privileged enough to spend a day with Bronco Nagurski, who during his time, many said he was not only the greatest wrestler of his time, but also the greatest football player of his time. But I took a liking to Lou Thesz because of I just found that in the ring he could produce, outside the ring he was a class act, and he was fun to work with and very, very caring about the business, David. He cared about the business and was sincere about it, and I had to respect that. But in my opinion, and of course there's always kind of all the type of debates, in my opinion he was the greatest when he was at his prime. But I loved the business, and Lou Thesz to me symbolized that business.
That was interesting in your book, talking about professional football. How many football players turn to professional wrestling to make money on the side? I'm glad you mentioned Bronco Nagurski. There's a great quote in your book, Peter, about he played football because he loved the sport, but he wrestled because he loved to eat. I mean, that's classic, right?
Yeah, and that came straight from Bronco himself. And I tell you, David, I look back, and that was a very significant day. I wish I had a tape recorder, and I just listened. Because I had about 6 hours with Bronco Nagurski, and he just loved telling me stories about the old days in football and wrestling. And as I mentioned in the book, I probably sat there with mouth wide open and eyes as big as saucers listening to it all. But that was a quote from him, and back then that was so true. He made money in wrestling so he could play football. When you think about some of the great things that the big money the football players made now, you know, it's probably unheard of for you and I to think of that a football player would drive 500 miles and play a football game for $15.
Right.
But that was very important because it showed how, just like professional wrestling, professional football had a start and it had an evolution and how it's grown into as big as it is today.
Yeah, this really continued for professional wrestling for quite a while because, I mean, you mentioned Jumpin' Joe Savoldi. You mentioned
right.
Bronco Nagurski. You mentioned, of course, the Destroyer Dick Beyer, Wahoo McDaniel. A lot of guys, I mean, in big stars in wrestling went on to be professional wrestlers and pro football players. We just won't see that today.
No, I think both the wrestling and football pay big money, and
yeah.
and these athletes are making such big money that they don't want to take the chance to get hurt in the sport that may not be their primary sport. And I'm not sure. I haven't seen a professional football contract, but I'm sure they've got some provisions in there that really limit the activities of their athletes after they put, you know, they invest so much money into them. But you got to remember too, back in the era that I write about, it was not just they loved the sports, is that they needed the money. Football was a short season. And during the off season, I mean, these football players weren't making this kind of money, even Wahoo McDaniel and Ernie Ladd. and so forth weren't making the kind of money that allowed them to sit back and not do anything during the off season. Mm-hmm. So wrestling kept them in shape. It kept them making money, and it worked out well for a period there for the wrestlers and football players to interchange.
Now, during the 1940s, World War II cost athletes part of their careers. Tell us about the night the Houston Symphony teamed up with Houston Wrestling to raise funds for World War II.
Well, that was a very interesting and historic night for Houston, Texas. The City Auditorium was the home, as you know, the weekly home of Houston Wrestling. But it was also the home of the Houston Symphony during the symphony season. And it kind of shows you the diversity of the building, that it can switch from symphony over to wrestling and back and forth.
Right.
But what happened was that the you had Roy Cullen, who was a big philanthropist, big oil tycoon in Houston. In fact, if you read the book The Big Rich, they even make reference to the story of how he put together this fundraiser with professional wrestling. And he got with Morris Siegel, who I mentioned before, is very community-minded. And, of course, to raise money for the war effort, I mean, both those individuals, all you had to do is mention that, and they were rolling up their sleeves saying, okay, what can we do? But what an interesting night. Paul Boscher, we've heard firsthand stories from people years ago who were there.
Mm-hmm.
But can you imagine, David, in one seat is a symphony lover and the next seat over is a professional wrestling lover. And what they did was they didn't have segregated sections. They all sat together and they played the symphony music in between the matches, which it had to be quite a sight. And then, of course, as I point out in the book, Elvis Becerra stole the show because he actually had a music background from the University of Oklahoma. So when he finished winning his match and he's still bloody and sweaty in his wrestling tights, he goes up there and he grabs the baton from the conductor and he led the symphony into the next song. So, which wrestling fans got a big kick out of, but as I pointed out in the book, the music critics of Houston really thought Elvis Becerra set them back 50 years. But it turned out that they raised over $1 million. You know, in the 40s, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, that's right.
They raised over $1 million, and you bought a war bond, and that was your ticket to get into the matches.
At this time, Gorgeous George, of course, was a big star in pro wrestling. What are your memories of Gorgeous George?
I faintly remember as I was growing up, again, I was a youngster in the 50s, and I remember meeting him in the dressing room, obviously, and I, of course, being a young boy, I was just fascinated by him, his color and his flamboyancy and so forth. And, you know, he's a Houston product. He actually grew up in Houston. In fact, he grew up around the Milby High School area, for any listeners or readers who are familiar with Houston. And tough guy, as you know. He would put on the show, and then when it came down to get down to wrestling, he could do that too. And that's what made him so popular. But, of course, he came along at the right time. He came along just in time to have his character built ready for national TV. So, again, timing is everything in sports and entertainment, and Gorgeous George was in the right place at the right time.
The females started to gain traction in the business at this time, women like Mildred Burke and the Fabulous Moolah. How did crowds treat the women back then?
Well, back then it was kind of more of a unique to have the female wrestlers in the, but it was still part of the Morris Eagle found as part of a great way to keep your wrestling promotion from becoming stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have the female wrestlers coming in, and in later years you'd have the midget wrestlers like Lord Littlebrook coming in. But then Morris Eagle, as I write in the book, even took it a couple steps further and had the alligator man to wrestle
right.
The alligator, and then the match with the man against the lion, which almost turned into a huge disaster. Every time Paul Bosch would tell me the story, he would just shake his head and say, "Thank God that lion didn't get out of that cage." Because there's no telling what could have happened as thousands of people tried to head for the doors. So, but anyway, and it only took one time with the lion that Morris Eagle learned his lesson that there was no more wrestling lions in Houston wrestling. But plenty of bears through the years, different bears would come traveling through, and even I had the privilege of wrestling the bear one time, and I wrote about that in the book. I think. Readers, David, are going to enjoy the book. At least I hope they do, and everybody I've talked to read it has. It's an insight on professional wrestling of that era. It's a history of Houston wrestling. But as you pointed out earlier, it's a correlation with the regional promotions of those years.
Yeah.
I mean, what was happening in Houston would those same wrestlers so forth 2 years later to be running the same angles and so forth in the Carolinas or the Virginia or the Midwest. And what's really been fun is talking to readers who grew up in other parts of the country
mm-hmm.
and who have read the book, and they say, it took me back to my youth. I watched those same wrestlers when I was a kid, and I didn't realize that they were traveling around the country. So that's been one of the fun things is talking to readers who enjoyed the book.
I really liked reading through it and learning about how Houston was very creative in their booking. You mentioned wrestling, you know, animals such as the alligators, the lions. You know, you had dangerous barbed wire matches and lumberjack matches and even in-ring weddings. A couple references to having famous boxers come in as special referees. My question, though, Peter, is how challenging is it for promotion to keep your programming fresh?
Well, back then you had a weekly promotion, and you're exactly right. That was the challenge. And then you got immediate feedback. I mean, you put together a card or a match and you put on a show, and all of a sudden you look in the crowd in the arena and it's jam packed. You say, I did my job, but you know, you didn't have time to sit back and relax. You already had to have your television and your angles and your storylines already built up for the next week. And the good thing about a weekly promotion is that if you did miss the mark a little bit, you didn't have quite the crowd you wanted. You didn't have time to worry about it. You're busy next week rolling up your sleeves and building up that show.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it was hard. It was hard to keep the angles going each week because of the weekly. And as we found out in the later years, in the final years of Houston Wrestling, when we promoted on a 2- and 3-week basis, I found it a lot easier. It gave you more time to lay out the story. But it was challenging, and Moore Siegel and Paul Bosch and we tried to meet it with, mixing things up, and as you said before, bringing the different kind of added attractions that catches people's imagination.
One of the central themes that I found in this book was the impact of television. And as we moved into the 1950s, you know, you saw the invention of television, and in some ways it really helped professional wrestling, and in some ways it hurt. You talk in the book how boxing and wrestling, because of the stationary cameras of the time, it showed very well on television. The lighting was sometimes a challenge, but you had to get used to the fact that sometimes ticket sales may be down. People would stay at home instead of buying tickets because they could see it on TV. So explain the use, Peter, of the tease and please approach to making sure you were still selling tickets.
Well, what happened is in the early days of television, you're right, wrestling, professional wrestling and boxing was basically married to television and vice versa. Television sports programming, because of logistical reasons, the technical lighting of a stationary object and the way the cameras weighed several hundred pounds each and you couldn't move them around. So the uniqueness of television, it really helped with professional wrestling and boxing in the early 50s, because boxing went through the same evolution, but I'll focus on discussing wrestling. And then there came a time, you're exactly right, the wrestling fans started saying, you know what, it's raining outside and I don't know if I want to go downtown Houston, I'll just turn on TV and watch the show there. So that's what happened. And then when it started really hurting the gates, and then Moore Siegel's case, it was not only hurting the gates, but it was also hurting his beer and popcorn sales.
Yeah,
that he realized that he had to change. And it took a while. It took a few years, and a lot of regional wrestling promotions, David, went bankrupt because they weren't able to adjust quick enough. But it came to where you come up with this tease on television, and then you please in the arena. And you didn't do that every night, obviously, and you didn't do that every television show. But if you ever take a look back at what took place in all these regional promotions, television was there to tease, and then when they came and paid their money and got into the arena, it was time to please. And as I said before, you couldn't please them every night, but you could also try to do so.
Now, your uncle Paul Bosch really was the heart and soul of Houston wrestling by the end of the 1940s. Unfortunately, a car accident forced him to the front office, where he then became a legendary broadcaster, the host, if you will, of Houston Wrestling with Paul Bosch. Why was Paul so good on television?
Well, at first, he was the first person to be on television. The first week there was television in Houston, Texas, there was two shows on, and one was Houston Wrestling with Paul Bosch, and the other was Milton Berle, and on his national syndicated show. So he came on television. Really, there's no comparison. I mean, the fans were, for the first time, they saw somebody describing and watching a wrestling show on television. But I think what Paul did was Paul, just being Paul Bosch, he was a very personal guy. And if you met him in person, people liked him. He liked people. And you know, you and I both know that persona comes across on television. And you know, you've seen through the years where some wrestler says, well, I'm going to be a heel, but he's not really a natural heel. Well, wrestling fans pick that up, and vice versa if they want to be a baby face. So he came across very likable. People really liked him. In fact, there was even a strong push for him to run for the U.S. Senate at one time in the late 50s and early 60s. But also, he was careful, along with Boris Siegel in the early days, and then when he became the promoter, we became the producers, we were careful not to do the things on television that would pop the ratings for a couple weeks, but then in the long run hurt the credibility of the wrestling show. So you had to find that balance, David. Yes, there was things that you could do. There's angles you could shoot, you know, on television that would really pop the crowd and pop the ratings. But after a while, you do that, you turn around, and you have no television show. You have no promotion because you did not keep that level of consistent stability and credibility. It was important back then.
Some really good stories in the book about your uncle. I mean, the fact that he was friends with George H.W. Bush. You guys even had coffee at the White House.
Right, and that was very nice, being invited up. He was vice president at the time, but we were able to have coffee with him. And he grew up in Houston, and I've been pointed out in the book that when he first ran for Congress in Houston, he came by the wrestling show. I mean, he came by the wrestling office, and Paul Bosch, and he sat down and talked. And they really took a liking to each other. Now, we're talking about somebody who hadn't even been elected to Congress. And so Paul invited him to come down to the matches that week and be introduced to the crowd and also to be introduced on television. And back then, you didn't have this equal time. So we could go up to on television and endorse him for Congress without opening the door and having to have his opponent have equal time on our television show. In fact, one time when he was running, Wahoo McDaniel was in town, Papa Bush, about how he's referred to, he legitimately was Wahoo McDaniel's Little League baseball coach in Midland, Texas, when they both were living out there and Wahoo was growing up. And of course, Wahoo McDaniel at the time was red hot in the market, and he came out and gave an endorsement to him in the ring, but also on television. So we always had that relationship, and as I pointed out in the book, a very unique friendship between Paul Bosch and President Bush. And it was interesting as a young man and growing up and watch that thing develop, even to the extent that I thought, and I pointed out in the book, how amazing it was that the President of the United States would wake up one morning and feel an urge to contact a friend and did so wrote a note. He told us, I had this tremendous urge to contact Paul, and he wrote a note to him, and late that same day was the day that my uncle passed away and never received the note. So it is somehow that just points out the unique relationship that they had, that close feeling towards each other.
Yeah, it was very touching. I also like the story, the fact that Paul introduced Stu Hart to Helen Smith. That worked out pretty well for everybody.
Yes, it did. In fact, Helen Smith was in the same high school as my mother and father went to down there in Long Beach. But Paul would always chuckle and said that was his contribution to the world population.
You know, one of the real highlights of this book, Peter, is the list of stars every decade that came through Houston. It's really remarkable. I mean, even, you know, in the 50s with Vern Gagne and Killer Kowalski, of course, Red Bastien, Nick Bockwinkel, and you move into the 60s, and it just gets better and better. Ernie Ladd, of course, you mentioned Indian Chief Wahoo McDaniel. But real quick, before we move forward, I wanted to go back to in the early 1950s when Morris Siegel became the first vice president of the NWA. Why was that so important at the time?
Well, because it was Houston wrestling was getting on the map and becoming one of the major markets for the business. And also, I think I tried to demonstrate the early relationship with the National Wrestling Alliance. was very important, was formed in the early years, and then, as I pointed out in the book, for many, many years, we were a very strong market and very strong supporters of the NWA. But as you got into the 80s, a lot of things changed.
Mm-hmm.
The business changed, loyalties changed, and the politics changed. And before you know it, we were no longer had that close association with the NWA. But I wanted to point out to wrestling fans of today that the NWA started way back then,
yep.
And that it was very important to have that connection, because in the early goings, Houston became and always was, when we were even when we were promoting at the end, a world title town. And so to be a world title town, you had to have a strong connection with the NWA and have access to their world champion. So I thought that was also Moore Siegel's way of being just a smart businessman. He knew that that association was going to be allow him to get more talent and to please his wrestling fans.
Houston Wrestling, also a great tag team promotion. A lot of great tag teams came through. It was also, more importantly, very on the forefront of racial progress. You talk in the book about how it had the first African-American girls match and how Luthez wrestled the African-American champion. It was really a progressive promotion in a lot of ways, correct?
Yes, it was. And again, this was taking place in other parts of the country. I think Houston had a few steps ahead of everybody else. But you may find it interesting that at one time you could not, as a promoter, put a black wrestler in against a white wrestler. It was against the law.
Hmm.
And because I think the fear would be, no matter what happened in the ring, it may spill over into the crowd. And you also have to remember back in those days that we had a segregated section. And, you know, it's hard for us, especially someone as young as you, to realize that. But I saw it as a youngster, that you would go into an arena and there would be the colored section and then there'd be the white section.
Wow.
And it sounds so ridiculous now, but that's the way it was back then. And I tried to capture a little bit of that in the book too. I really, the main objective of the book was, I woke up one day and I had been out of the wrestling business for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. I had a great run in it and I loved every moment of it. But I woke up and most of the wrestlers that worked for me were gone. Most of the promoters that I worked with were gone. Most of the fans were gone. And David, thank goodness for people like you and your organization on the internet, your website. You guys are the backbone of the fan base. And I was afraid that if I don't start putting some of this stuff down, it's going to be lost when I go.
Mm-hmm.
And so I very much dedicated to trying to preserve the history and heritage of not only Houston wrestling, but regional wrestling promotions and wrestling of that era. In fact, later today, I have a filmmaker coming by who read the book, and he now wants to do a documentary on Houston wrestling. So and I think that's important. And again, my hat goes off to you and Alex and your organization, because you guys keep it alive. You preserve it for the wrestling fans, and really, that's what I would like to help do now. Is to be involved in some way, if somehow I can get documented what I've known, what I've experienced, for wrestling fans of the future. I'd love for some of my wrestling fans for 10, 15, 20 years from now, pick up the book and say, I wonder what it was like back in the days of Wahoo McDaniels and Ernie Ladd and
mm-hmm.
Lou Fez. And I also tried to point out how different the business was. Wrestlers were their own contractors, and they came up with their own characters and gimmicks. And so it wasn't like today, where a lot of that is done for them. So I was able to capture that and help preserve some of that history.
Well, there's no question you did. From everything from how you incorporated television to the importance of being a weekly show versus a monthly show. And you talk about your role in it. I wanted to ask you, though, can you explain again how Ernie Ladd helped you get your first on-screen role?
Well, actually, I was always grateful to Ernie. We became good friends, and I always thanked him for it. But I was in the dressing room and working, and so was Paul Bosch. And Ernie Ladd was in town. He wasn't working for us that night, but he wanted to do a promo for Atlanta Wrestling, and he knew we had the television remote truck at the Coliseum. So he came by, and he even, back in those days, David, you wrestlers used to carry around blank 2-inch promo tapes in their suitcases.
Huh.
Because you never knew when you could get a chance to shoot a promo and send it off to a future booking. So when he walked in and asked permission, he asked Paul if he could do a promo for Atlanta Wrestling, and Paul said, sure, and started to reach for his jacket. And then Ernie just told Paul, not you, Paul, I want Pete. And he pointed to me, and of course, I was kind of shocked, and so was Paul. And then I figured, well, this is an opportunity, so I grabbed my coat, got on there. And of course, Ernie Ladd's one of the great talkers.
Yeah.
I didn't have to talk very much. All you do is introduce Ernie Ladd, and he took it from there. He was a great talker. But see, when my uncle went into the TV truck and watched it with the TV director, and the way he towered over me, Ernie Ladd was a showman. He knew that, you know what, against me, he was going to look like a giant, and against Paul Bosch, who was 6'2", he would not have been as impressive. But it came off well, and I was always grateful to Ernie, because after that, I had the assignment for either the very small wrestlers or the very tall wrestlers, and that was my role, to be the straight man for those guys.
Mm-hmm. Now, sadly, Gorgeous George died in 1963 of a heart attack. It was also the same year that the Sam Houston Coliseum started hosting your shows. Now, you write in the book that this was a great venue, but it did present some new problems. Can you elaborate?
Well, sports fans are creatures of habit. And even though the Coliseum, strangely enough, was only like 6-7 blocks away from the old city auditorium, getting fans to walk those 6 or 7 blocks, It was a tough challenge. But if you notice, the first few shows that Morris Siegel put in the Coliseum, he did it during the summer. There's a very important reason. The Sam Houston Coliseum was air-conditioned. The city auditorium was not. I can't even imagine how hot that city auditorium was.
Right.
When you have 100-plus degrees outside and you have 4,000 wrestling fans jammed into an arena. But he would purposely started weaning them away from the city auditorium and go to the Coliseum. Air conditioning, plus the fact was that he could get 10,000 wrestling fans in. And if you also spotted in the book there that a lot of those promotions he did was a dollar night or 99 cent a ticket night, well, you know, someone may say, how did he make any money as a promoter? Well, remember, he made money off the beer and popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in a position he could almost give away the tickets and make his money that night from the concession.
Now, sadly, Morris Siegel died in 1967, so your uncle Paul Bosch basically took over the promotion. And at the dawn of the 1970s, in fact, the NWA declared Houston the wrestling city of the 70s at their annual convention. What an honor, huh?
Yes, it was. And actually, when Morris Siegel passed away, the Houston Wrestling was in a down cycle. Morris Siegel's health was not allowing as much time being put into the promotion, and for various other reasons, Paul. They were having some trouble with the television being bounced around, and you and I both know that doesn't help ratings when they bounce you from one night to a different night.
Right, right.
And the reason why that was happening was the networks down here in Houston, being a big television market, David, they were being flooded with syndicated shows that have nationally syndicated shows. So as they got jam packed with nationally syndicated show, naturally, the local promotion, the local television show, got moved around. So it really happened at the at a time, and then one of the best moves Paul made when he first came as a promoter is he hooked up with Channel 39, which was an independent station. And those of you wrestling historians like yourself know that was very important at that time for wrestling promoters, because the independent stations did not have the nationally syndicated shows. They had more flexibility, and they loved the connection to the local market that wrestling promoters gave them. And wrestling promoters loved it because they had a television station that was much more willing to work with them, and so both parties benefited.
Mm-hmm. Well, throughout the 70s, Paul certainly booked a lot of great talent. Again, the list is just unbelievable. Handsome Harley Race, Ric Flair, Greg Valentine, Superstar Billy Graham. I mean, the list goes on. Andre the Giant. But more importantly, you yourself wrestled a bear and survived. And in the book, you tell us the quote-unquote secret you need to know, before you're locking up with a grizzly.
Yes, it was a unique situation, as I wrote about in the book, and I hope readers enjoy the story, and that I was not too happy at first and not too thrilled about the whole thing. But thank goodness Nick Adams whispered the secret in my ear, and I was able to survive and actually, I look back at it and enjoyed the experience. But at the time, I was not that thrilled until Nick Adams whispered the secret in my ear, and that we'll probably let readers read the book, and so they know the secret of Wrestling Bear. You never know when you're going to encounter a Wrestling Bear, so that may be a secret that fans may want to know.
What made Dory Funk Jr. such a great world champion?
Well, interesting enough, when the NWA, he became the champion, there was a lot of promoters who had second doubts because obviously he came from a colorful family and obviously had a great deal of respect for his father, Dory Funk Sr., and they knew he had great wrestling ability, Dory Jr., but they were just concerned about the outside-the-ring persona. But when he came down and he performed in the ring, and Houston wrestling fans gained a tremendous respect for him, and then he had the added advantage of having a father as colorful as Dory Sr., and then, of course, you're not going to find anybody more colorful than Terry Funk, and to have those two be the charisma outside the ring, and yet he was the producer in the ring, for Houston, that worked out a tremendous formula. We made a lot of money with the Funks, and they made a lot of money here in Houston, because inevitably you didn't battle Dory Jr. If you were Walter McDaniels or Jose Lothario or Johnny Valentine, you didn't battle Dory Jr. You took on the whole Funk family. Of course, as a weekly promoter, that made our job a lot easier because we could book Dory Sr., we could book Terry. And then whenever the storyline was taken to the hilt, then you would bring in the world champion. So we made a lot of money with Dory Jr., and I've always had a lot of respect for the Funk family.
The city of Houston really appreciated the work of Paul Bosch, and he was selected as Mr. Sportsman. What did that honor mean to him?
Well, it was interesting because it kind of symbolizes what we talked about before, about the interaction with the community. How you give back to the community. But the interfaith charities, you know, having a religious groups that select you as Mr. Sportsman was a unique honor because they respected what he did, for not only for the community, but for various religious organizations and for people in general. And, of course, it was fun watching my uncle receive that honor, but it also gave me the opportunity to spend the day with Bronco Nagurski. So looking back at it, and that was a fun event. Paul really appreciated the honor, and of course, Paul being a promoter, David, you appreciate this. He, in order to make sure, you know, when he got selected, the first thing we wanted to make sure is that the banquet sold out.
Right.
Because you don't want to be selected as Mr. Sportsman and have half the ballroom. So Paul was smart enough to get on the phone and invite Bronco Nagurski down. Well, that's all you had to do is put on the program that Bronco Nagurski was going to be there, and we sold out the ballroom. But a typical promoter, you know, you get selected Mr. Sportsman, you don't want to have the ballroom half-filled. So he called up his good friend Bronco Nagurski, and everybody had a great time that night.
Sadly, you have to detail some of the tragic deaths that started to occur, such as Al Torres and Ray Gunkel, and some in the ring and some outside the ring as part of just the lifestyle of being a professional wrestler. Peter, how do these tragedies impact the locker room?
Well, it really affected the locker room, especially when you had some of the tragedies that you saw as tragedies you hope could have been prevented. You know, when I think of gorgeous Gino Hernandez, I lost a very dear friend. I lost a very dear friend in Bruiser Brody. And you look back at those events and say, God, couldn't that be avoided? I mean, couldn't... Sometimes there's friction between the promoters and the wrestlers and so forth, but you have that in every sport. But couldn't they just shake hands and say, thank you very much, and then, you know, Bruiser Brody never go down to Puerto Rico again, or
right,
the promoter never book them again. So the tragedies that you were just that you felt could be prevented, they were harder to accept, harder to digest. Of course, when you have some that were events that you really couldn't stop, it was still very hard. But, boy, when I look back and with Gino and Bruiser and what I'd give to have both of them still alive today, and they had both had so much to offer, not only, you know, their families, because Bruiser Brody and Gino were very strong family individuals, but to the sport and to the business themselves. I mean, you know, both of those guys would have fell right into the big pop by the WWE. I think both of those talents would have fit right in.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you talk about the effects of no-shows on a promotion. For example, there was one night Harley Race did not appear, and that became a real challenge for you dealing with that situation with the live crowd. Explain how difficult that is for a promoter when you put together a card and they say it's subject to change, but then when it does change.
Well, of course, especially when you have to change the main event and the world champion. I mean, when you go out and you sell tickets to see the world champion defend his title and he doesn't show,
yep.
Well, you know, that's hard to compensate. That I really think the first no-show by Harley Race, well, I do think was an honest mistake. I do think that he was in a motel room waiting for a night show, and it was a 3 o'clock starting show, and so I do think that was a mix-up and an honest element. But it goes back to the old days when Luthez and the world champions, back in those days, David, when they got into town, they made a phone call to the promoter. It was just standard procedure. When you got into town, you called the promoter, whether it's Morris Siegel, Paul Bosch, and you say, okay, I'm in town, I'll see you at the Coliseum.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately, we didn't get that phone call from Harley Race. The next time he has no show, I really do not know if there was political forces involved in that. As I mentioned in the book, there was a silver lining on his first no-show on the summit. Nick Bockwinkel, who has a very strong relationship with us, came down as AWA champion to be on the super card, and he wrestled a 60-minute match, but then he stepped in for Harley Race and put in another 60-minute match. And I tell you what, wrestling fans left the summit that day with a whole new respect for Nick Bockwinkel, and as you know, he played a major role in the latter years of Houston wrestling. But can you imagine? I mean, Nick was a great performer and great action producer,
mm-hmm.
but to have 2 60-minute matches in the same afternoon and have those fans screaming and hollering for more, he was one of the best.
I thought there was an interesting quote on page 135. You write that, quote unquote, the show impressed not only Houston wrestling fans, but fans around the wrestling world. My question for you, Peter, is how did fans around the wrestling world find out about these kind of results at this time back in the 1970s?
Well, of course, we didn't have internet back then, and websites
right.
like yours had to help spread the word. But you had wrestling magazines, and we were billing it as Super Sunday in the Summit. And it was, and when you take a look at the card, it was a Super Sunday in many respects. And so we had magazine writers there. But you also had some wrestling fan publications, like Dave Meltzer's The Wrestling Observer was getting started back then, and some of the others. Not anything with the reach and pull that you have, but it didn't take long before the hardcore wrestling fans developed their own network, and even though it may not be as powerful as it is today, it still was very formidable as word got around of what took place in the summit that day. And so, and like I say, the silver lining was Nick Bockwinkel elevated himself with Houston wrestling fans and also with the promotion. But, I look at what you guys do today online and so forth. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing the way that y'all, help establish that fan base.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I want to touch quickly on the Paul Bosch 45th anniversary show that took place October 21st, 1977. A big success for Houston wrestling. How important was that night for Paul?
It was important because Paul was very proud to be involved in wrestling and have a career that at the time was 45 years. And even then, he had turned to me and he had said he said, I'll probably be getting out at the 50th. But he was very proud of that, and he saw it as a way to celebrate it. And, of course, we kept a personal relationship with a lot of wrestlers through the years. We had booking offices that provided much of the talent, but our own personal relationships would bring in people. If you take a look at our wrestling cards, you can see we were bringing in people that weren't quite working for the booking office of that region at the time. And people would want to be involved in that, and they would I'll come down and help you celebrate Paul. So before you knew it, you had a long list of top talent, and of course they came in and produced because it was all kind of a special celebration, and the fans got into it too. So it was very important to Paul to be able to celebrate with fans, and whenever we did those kind of anniversaries, and especially the Paul Bosch Extravaganza, his retirement, fans really got into it because they felt like they were part of Paul's family as well. Mm-hmm. So they were always fun.
Now, it was around this time that you started your career as a solo promoter in the secondary markets like Galveston, Texas. Can you discuss a little bit about how exciting that was for you to be a solo promoter working those regions? And also, you were deciding whether to go to school or not. So what kept you in the business?
Well, what kept me in the business was first my relationship to my uncle. Mm-hmm. And the we were very, very close. We were uncle and nephew, but I think the inscription I put in the book, I wanted readers to understand it was more than just an uncle and nephew. And if they read that inscription that he wrote to me when I helped him with his first manuscript on his book, so that was number one. But it was also an exciting business. You know, the creativity, the strategy sessions on the Mondays in the office when Paul and I would get our cup of coffee, and I'd come in with the list of wrestlers on the legal pad that I just got from the booker, who's available 2 weeks away, and they would have to start talking about putting our TV show together, and also who's going to work with who on the live shows. The creativity was fun. It was a challenge. I tell you, it's not a greater feeling than to put something together, and you go to the Coliseum that night, you have a sellout crowd, and everybody's having a great time. You're saying, wow, we made this thing happen. Now, there were some nights you looked up in the crowd and you said, wow, we missed something.
Mm-hmm.
But the creativity and the challenge kept me in there. And then going out on my own was Paul and I had talked about it. He said, Pete, I had no interest in promoting these other markets, but he could tell that I was young, ambitious, and I was anxious to go out there. And you learn so much more when I was a co-promoter with Paul in Houston, but when you're on your own, you do pick up experiences, and I wrote about some of those unique experiences, and I tried again give readers some insight what it was like to be a promoter back then. And what you did, and I mean, I would get a list of wrestlers. You know, in the later years, a booking office would just send you a card, say, here's your card, go out and promote it. But back then, I'd get a list of wrestlers, and I'd have to put my own card together. And between you and I had a big, big advantage, and I pointed it out in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I ran either a Thursday night or Saturday night because I could always piggyback a booking from my secondary markets with the Eastern Wrestling booking.
Right, that's a good point.
So if you were a top talent and I said, hey, Dave, why don't you come down and work Rosenberg, Texas? You'd probably say, I think I'm busy that night. But I come in and I say, you know, Dave, I can give you a booking in Houston. And the night before, you know, at Rosenberg, you say, fine, that'll work. The easiest town to book I ever found was Galveston, Dave. The wrestlers loved coming in, working Thursday night, and then they had all day on the beach on Friday before they had to be in Houston that Friday night. So that was an easy town to get top talent to come in for.
Well, you became the successor of Houston Wrestling really at the time when regional wrestling promotions were in their twilight. Still got great talent, Tony Atlas, Junkyard Dog, of course, you know, James J. Dillon, Kamala, a whole list of great stars. And you write in the book that Paul Bosch had a good relationship with Vince Sr., but Vince Jr. started to make it tougher to secure his talent.
And again, the relationship we had with Vince Jr., it was not personally, we've always liked Vince. And then Paul grew up, as I point out in the book, when he first started wrestling, he wrestled for Vince's grandfather. So there was a long-standing relationship with him and the McMahons. And, of course, Vince Jr.'s father was close with Paul, and that's why while he was still alive, we never did WWF at that time, didn't come into our market. It kind of reminded me of the book of the movie The Godfather, you know, when Vito Corleone tells Michael, wait until he's gone and then he can make his move.
Right.
And I think in a lot of ways in markets like Houston, I think that's what happened. Vince Jr.'s father passed away, and then Vince Jr., smart businessman. I mean, he changed the business. I have regrets on that because I loved the way it was. But you know what? You can't argue with success. Look what he has done with the WWE. So always personally, and then we did have the privilege of working with him for a few months as partners, but it was just the two different styles of promotion. Plus, the business was changing.
Yep.
The regional promotions, they were of yesteryear, and the new Vince represented the new wave of way the business was going and what direction the business was going to go.
I thought it was very interesting in the book how Houston Wrestling changed booking offices several times, leaving, you know, Dallas and hiring the Southwest Championship Wrestling booking office run by Joe and Tully Blanchard. Did those kinds of political decisions really weigh on you and take some of the fun out of being a wrestling promoter?
It did, because it took away some of the stability, but they were necessary. The 80s required change, and if you didn't change, you didn't survive. And of course, those moves were all encouraged by business was down. And then when you look at a booking office and you find that they can't provide the top talent that can draw you the money, okay? Back then, though, if you got to remember the 80s, there was a lot of the stars were being gobbled up by Vince and signed to exclusive contracts. Well, our friends that we used to be able to call up and say, hey, why don't you come down and give us a couple of dates? Well, we couldn't go that route as well. And I think a lot had to do with the talent that was in Southwest Championship Wrestling at the time. They had Walker McDaniel and Ivan Putski and some of these mainstay established superstars, even though they're established in the 70s, they were names that Houston wrestling fans knew, and so be able to have that access to those well-known, proven stars was important. Plus, without going into a whole lot of politics, breaking away from the Dallas office opened up being able to book some other top talent who, for various reasons through the years, were not exactly on the Dallas booking office's Christmas card list. So. It was all political moves, and of course, probably the best talent move was when we hooked up with Bill Watts, and who I still say to this day had one of the most creative minds in the business, whether it was in the ring, David, or on the television shows. Bill Watts had a unique ability, and if you take a look at all the superstars he established, they went on to other places, but he was one of the best.
Well, you spend a good deal of time in the book talking about Bill Watts and how he eventually did buy a portion of Houston Wrestling. But in some ways, that was good, and he did provide good talent. But he was difficult to work with at times. This is an experience we've heard from a lot of people, that he could be a real challenge.
He could. I got on great with Bill, but I could tell by his nature that I could see where some people would not feel as comfortable about it, but I think one of the things that really helps is when he came on board in Houston Wrestling, as I point out in the book, and I think readers are going to enjoy seeing the behind the scenes, what's happening. It's a business. And when Bill Watts bought in, the first thing he did is he and I met to decide whose roles and what responsibilities, and we were able to make it very clear cut what I was responsible for and what he was responsible for. And we just focused on what was our responsibilities. And Houston Wrestling had a really good run with Bill Watts in Mid-South, and I think it's one of the reasons was Bill Watts. But then you had people like Nick Bockwinkel involved. And he was, of course, obviously being part owner, he was giving us great dates, and he was helping us secure talent. So between, you know, Bill Watts and Nick Bockwinkel, and then all of a sudden we were able to reconnect with some of our stars of the past that they were able to come in and work Houston again. It gave us a really good run, because you've got to have top talent, especially if you're going to be a weekly or biweekly promotion.
Mm-hmm. And you became then a monthly promotion. Really, some business factors that were, you know, the reason for that. I thought it was fascinating in the book, Peter, that you talk about the locker room getting a little bit divided, because people were now kind of more out for themselves. They wanted to get to New York to work for Vince Jr., for maybe WCW, and it really did impact kind of the feel in the locker room.
It did, and for two reasons. One is that there was money involved, and whenever you have big money involved, you find athletes get a little bit more sensitive. They're humans, and the other thing was, it was not only just that, is that the network of you wrestling fans was improving, and then with the cable television, you couldn't do something in the Houston ring that was not known about elsewhere in the country. It used to be that you could do something in the Houston ring, you're leaving the territory, so you do business, and you get on a plane and you fly to another territory and you start making money.
Great
again.
Point. Yeah.
And but you couldn't do that. And so you're sitting there saying, well, for the business, for the town, this would be best, and the wrestler would look at you and say, that's not best for me. And again, as you say, they were all positioning themselves for WWF, but they also positioned themselves that they didn't want to do anything that would hurt their image and really reduce their marketability.
That's a great point, and it's another impact of television and how technology changed. There's also a point in your book where you talk about market segmentation and how they were now able to track television ratings better. Can you discuss how market segmentation really reshaped the business and the kind of superstars you put in the ring?
It was tremendous for a couple of reasons. Number one, it produced the real television ratings. For years, when they do a phone-in survey or a diary or whatever, as you know, many wrestling fans back then would say, my grandmother watched wrestling, or my grandfather, or my dad. Very few times would someone come up to me and say, I watched wrestling. But, you know, it takes 2 minutes into the end, not even 2 minutes, a minute into the conversation, I could tell that this is the real wrestling fan, the way he was talking about the show. But it enhanced the marketability of the wrestling shows. It showed advertisers they're getting the money's worth. And look what it did to Vince. I mean, coming from Madison Square Garden, New York City, Wall Street area, all of a sudden have these national marketers say, wow, you guys are really reaching some people, and you're reaching women, and you're reaching segments like teenage girls who – marketers love teenage girls because they spend money. And so that really was a big plus. And again, I say that's a lot of the success of Vince in the 80s with it all came along. Timing was so important. He was the man in position that when the television ratings came out and opened up all these new avenues of support, he was in the right position at the right time. So, and then it also pointed out to promoters, and I was, you know, I got an MBA from Sam Houston State University, mm-hmm. and I firm believer in market segmentation, but Paul was from the old school, that yes, you could have a young, small star, good-looking star that draws some money, but eventually you have to feed them to the big guys, and when you do, he loses his box office appeal. But the television ratings really helped convince people like Paul that, you know what, if you have the Rock and Roll Express that can pack the Coliseum, then you need some heels like the Midnight Express and Jim Cornette. I love Jim Cornette. I love doing interviews with him. But mm-hmm. what a storyline! What great angles! And as you read the book and also find out more about Houston Wrestling, we had a great run there of tag team, Fantastics, the Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express. The Guerrero brothers, all this, and they were not the huge big wrestlers, but they would sell tickets just as well as the big ones did.
You know, there was a co-promotion in April of 1985 between Mid-South, Houston, and Dallas, trying to show the cooperation needed to challenge the WWF at the time. Why don't you think this kind of co-promotion worked long-term?
Well, I think what it was is that Vince McMahon, was making his move nationwide and was being successful in some areas. In some areas, it was a little bit tougher for him to enter the market, and Houston was one of them because we were so well established. But between you and I, long term, he was going to be the ultimate winner just because all – it was sort of like the Civil War. The North eventually was going to win over the South because of resources. So, but it was a symbolic move to show that the camaraderie of the regional promotions, that they were going to help each other. And there was some sharing of talent back then to help somebody, either to ward off Vince, or if they were making some kind of attempt in one of Vince's territory towns, there was sometimes cooperation. And it wasn't really, I really didn't see it as battle lines drawn. It was just smart business.
Mm-hmm.
For the Von Erichs to come down into Houston and us to co-promote, it was just a way of saying, you know what, the bottom line is business, and let's work together and make our business strong.
Now, the Nature Boy Ric Flair spent some time in Houston, and of course at that point he was already a worldwide star and would go on to be a legend in this business. But Shawn Michaels also spent some time in Houston. Did you see for him the stardom he would eventually achieve?
No. In fact, I remember him traveling to the Coliseum and as a young, very young man, not really in the business yet, and traveling in there with Jose Lothario. And I guess the same thing I could say about The Rock. You know, The Rock's grandfather, Chief Peter Maivia, worked for me, and his father, Rocky Johnson, worked for me, and you know, to have this young boy traveling around with Rocky Johnson, you know, his dad, yeah, boy, if I'd have known what The Rock was going to end up doing, I would have signed a personal service contract with him right away. But it's interesting how you point out that some of these people, they get involved at a young age, and then many of them turn on to be superstars. And so, no, it's interesting to watch that happen. It really was.
In 1986, we talked a little bit about Bill Watts. At this point, he started the Universal Wrestling Federation, the UWF. You were be promoted under this banner, but it said in the book there was tension almost from the beginning. And then in 1987, Paul Bosch does call the WWF to work out an agreement. How did you feel about, you know, working now with Vince to be under the World Wrestling Federation banner?
I think the realization that sank in to both Paul and I realized that first of all, medical reasons at the time, and just the fact that the business was not as fun as it used to be. It was not the same business that he grew up and spent his entire adult life in.
Right.
So he was easing out. I was involved in the business, but I could see the handwriting on the wall, and I was also having some other business opportunities and an opportunity to go back to teaching at San Diego State University. So it was almost like we saw the handwriting on the wall, and we were trying to structure it in such a way that we could just do the best we can with the current situation. And I understand what Bill Watts did. He had to, David. He had a television, his television syndication was starting to spread a little bit. Well, Mid-South Wrestling, just the name itself, sets off a regional tone. And so if he's going to compete against the WWF and the AWA and the NWA, he needed to position himself more as a national promotion than just the regional Mid-South. But it was the fact that it was all happening at a time that it was not as much fun. I missed the creative booking office meetings with Paul, and then also on the Friday afternoon when the booker would come in and we would meet and discuss the show that night. All that was gone, and I had other opportunities and a family that I wanted to spend more time with. But I understand what Bill Watts did, but at the same time, for a regional promoter, it was probably one of the last straws that broke the camel's back. And I think the fact that there was just miscommunication at the end, or lack of communication was probably a better way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and as I said in the book, maybe it was just inevitable. Maybe the regional promotions were the dinosaurs and they were becoming extinct. And that was just Paul and I were able to do it with Vince's help in grand style with the Paul Bosch extravaganza. And I had fortunately done very well in wrestling, and so I was able to move on to other things. It was just destiny.
Mm-hmm.
The regional promotions were on their way out.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book how, you know, you agreed to work with the WWF, and then some new financial proposals were put together, and the numbers did not work for Houston, so the promotion closed after 60 years, which is just remarkable. You had the great Paul Bosch retirement extravaganza, which was a big success. I love the quote in the book where Luthez says to you, as you think, it, you know, you're sad a bit because it's the end of the line, and he says, not for you, Pete. You are too young, and it is in your blood. It will always be in your blood. Is that still true? Are you still a fan? Do you still love the business?
Well, I do. The business of today, I'm not that fond of, and I respect it. Boy, I see what they do. I see what happens with organizations, you know, like yourself, with the fan network, and I say, wow, talk about big business. So I respect what Vince has done, but I just remember there was a camaraderie that I felt when I was in promotion of wrestling of yesteryear. And that was a very interesting time, because when Luthez told me that as we were heading back to the locker room, I was not, you know, I just didn't put much emphasis in it, too. I got out, and I was out for just a few months, and then when I had the opportunity to get back in, I knew I had to do it. But, David, you're young, but you haven't faced this challenge yet. When you get older, you're in a career that really means the world to you, you're going to find that all of a sudden it comes a time you look yourself in the mirror and say, it's time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's sort of like a good finish on a match. It's time.
Time to go home.
And I looked in the mirror, and I had a great run with Jim Crockett Promotions. I really enjoyed those 9 months with his organization.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, and I enjoyed bringing back Houston Wrestling. We were starting to get – the crowds were getting bigger and the ratings were getting better when all of a sudden Jim Crockett ran into a whirlwind. But it was time. And I'm glad I had that last stint within Jim Crockett Promotions, because I think it would have left a void in me if I didn't. But after that, it was time. And I spent so much of my life on professional wrestling But when it was time, I walked away, and I knew it was time. And you're not even close to that age yet, but you'll understand someday when you're doing something you love, and all of a sudden it starts to change so much that you look yourself in the mirror and say,
I am 40 this year, and I wouldn't mind a little more relaxation time, but I thought it was a very satisfying ending to your story, because people may not know you did start teaching at Sam Houston State University, but then in late 87, you did go back to work for Jim Crockett as a special events coordinator, bringing back the Houston promotion, but then once Ted Turner bought the NWA and moved basically the offices to Atlanta, you just decided that you wanted to concentrate on your family and other parts of your life. And I thought that was a really nice way to end your story, because it seemed like you were very comfortable with your career.
I was, and I sometimes worry about whether I got too personal in the book, and my two sons encouraged me to be personal, and I said, well, no one cares about Peter Burkholz. And they said, you're probably right, Dad, but they do care about a young man who grew up in a wrestling family and grew up in a wrestling promotion and made it to the top during a very exciting era. And he said, readers are going to be, they want to read about that young man. And so it was, and you're exactly right. Having this talk with you, I'm very impressed with the way that you remember so many of the key parts of the story in the book. But it was, I tried to give readers an idea. This what was, you know, we were people. We were wrestling promoters. We were wrestlers, but we were people. And then when the personal life, it gets intertwined with your professional, and then there comes a time that I was very happy, very content, and I was ready to. I look back on my days of wrestling with fondness, and I tell you, one of the fun things writing the book is getting involved and talking to good wrestling fans like yourself. But I've all of a sudden I've been contacted by wrestling fans I hadn't seen in 20, 25 years, and so it's been fun. It's been fun to get reconnected.
Now, in fairness, you know, because this is kind of a book review, and I did have a few small criticisms of the book, Peter. I just wanted to address with you quickly.
Sure.
Some of the stars in the book you mentioned, like Junkyard Dog, Randy Savage, Ric Flair, etc., little is mentioned about kind of the complexity of their real personas. I mean, we know a lot more now about the business than we did 20, 30 years ago. And are you surprised by some of the things that have come out in other books that people have written, or, you know, some of the kind of the personal stories people have written about maybe potential drug abuse or, you know, other things like that? They're not mentioned in this book. Was that on purpose, because that wasn't your intent? You're more of a storyteller here?
Well, I wanted to tell a story, and I felt the Houston wrestling story was a wonderful story, and I enjoyed telling it, and I still enjoy telling it, and hope to do so in the future. But, yes, there was some of that element out there. As a promoter, I wasn't naive enough to think that everybody involved was 100% squeaky clean and so forth. But I never was involved in it, never saw firsthand. And then at the same time, I'm one of these people that if you're going to write about, especially somebody who's not around anymore, I just felt like, you know, let's tell the great story, let's tell the wonderful story. And unfortunately, wrestling, like some other sports, does have some of that element in it that, as a promoter, I wish wasn't there. But you're right that I tried to just tell the story to make it an enjoyable story. And yes, there were some situations in there that I didn't go into, because I just felt like, what benefit would it be? I mean, especially when some of these wrestlers are gone and their kids could read this book, their grandchildren could read this book, their great-grandchildren could read this book. And I said, you know what? I don't know for sure, and I'm not going anywhere that I don't know for sure. So,
fair enough. Well, there are many, many great stories in the book, and we touched on some today, but, boy, there's a lot we didn't get to, and I highly encourage people to read the book. I love the quote on page 105 to finish up here, Peter. It says, quote, maybe that is what professional wrestling is all about, creating memories which fans cherish for the rest of their lives, unquote. I thought you did a great job capturing many of those in this book, and I think – above all else, quotes in the book, that for me stood out, because that's what professional wrestling has done for myself.
Well, that's great, and I appreciate that. And I really felt sincerely that's what wrestling was all about. And David, I do have a website.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody who's been any listeners or readers who want to get more information. It's called When Wrestling Was Wrestling, and it's wrestling spelled RASSLIN.com. So When Wrestling Was Wrestling.com. And there's a website that will not only have some pictures in it, but we hope to add to the website in the near future, but also links on how they can get the book. There's also a way that they can contact me if they have further questions or would further like to talk Houston wrestling. I tell you, I've really enjoyed this. It's been one of the fun events of publishing this book. At first, I thought I just wanted to restore the history, but talking to great fans like yourself, it does make it fun to help market the book. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and I hope someday I can meet you in person.
That would be great, and I really enjoyed it myself. I want to thank you again for joining me. We will certainly, when we post the interview, put there your website, www.whenwrestlingwaswrestling.com, so people can find you on the Internet. And like you said, there's ways to contact you and also some more information about the book. Congratulations on an excellent narrative. I really enjoyed reading it. And, again, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, David.
Take care.
All right, you too.
And don't forget to check out the OWW website and onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. Email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We'll also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. Until next time, I am David. Thank you again to Mr. Peter Burkholz, the author of the new book, When Wrestling Was Wrestling, for an entertaining interview today. Make sure you check out his website, www.whenwrestlingwaswrestling.com. We'll have all that information on OWW. We hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio. Well, that